From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor, over 110,000 Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps on the West Coast. They were not only stripped of their property, civil rights, and dignity, but although they were U.S. citizens, they were treated as enemies by their own government. In Just Americans, How Japanese Americans Won a War at Home and Abroad, a new book published by Gotham, Robert Asahina tells the story of the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team, a segregated Japanese-American unit in World War II, and for its size and length of service, the most decorated unit in American military history. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Asahina to my show today. Hello.
Hi. Glad to be here.
What was the argument for internment at the time?
Well, the idea was that Japanese-Americans were too closely identified with Japanese in Japan. And as one of the generals put it, you couldn't distinguish the sheep from the goats. And since you couldn't, they should all be treated as if they were disloyal.
And the military necessity was cited as a cause. Do you see any parallels with some prisoners who are being held today as a matter of military necessity?
There are, although the key difference is that the Japanese Americans who were rounded up after Pearl Harbor, most of them were citizens, and the government was, in effect, treating them as if they were not citizens. And that's what made this such a dramatic violation of civil liberties.
But there are legal precedents that were set in the Japanese internment that have been applied today, the Supreme Court decision in the Korematsu case.
Yeah, one of the things that people forget is that Korematsu is still on the books, and that the notion of military necessity, which was invoked at that time, has never been overturned, although as recently as 10 years ago, 8 of the 9 justices said that Korematsu was a mistake. Nonetheless, it's still on the books.
Yeah, and your book with a comparison of Pearl Harbor and 9/11 and the impact and debate over racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in particular, the contemporary liberals' uneasy relationship with military valor and the conservative columnist Michelle Malkin's post 9/11 take on Japanese American internment.
Well, the word internment is really kind of a red flag, because if the government had had the right to intern Japanese Americans, then it would have been something that was permitted under law. But they were treated as if they were not citizens, which is what internment does, but they actually were citizens. So the government actually had to create a whole new vocabulary to describe what they were doing. The first thing they said was, we're going to exclude Japanese Americans from the West Coast because you can't tell the sheep from the goats. The second thing is, we're going to evacuate them, that is, to remove them from their homes. The third thing the government said is, we will assemble them, that is, put them in temporary camps, which included the infamous Santa Anita racetrack, where horse stalls were converted into living quarters. And then fourth, they were going to be relocated, that is, moved to permanent camps in the interior.
And only on the West Coast? Why not in Hawaii, for example, where there were many more Japanese Americans? Why not on the East Coast?
Well, Hawaii is really the test case that shows this whole notion of military necessity was a fake one, because there actually were more Hawaiian Japanese Americans than there were Japanese Americans on the mainland, and they in fact constituted close to 40% of the population of the islands. And they were so closely integrated with the political structure, with the economy, and even with the military in Hawaii, that they couldn't be easily segregated and removed. It would really have destroyed the war effort in Hawaii.
But they saw the people on the West Coast as a fifth column, which they would have also been in Hawaii if they had less power.
Yeah, I think it really boils down to the question of power. On the mainland, Japanese Americans were less than 0.1% of the population. So from the standpoint of the majority population, it was pretty easy to make them disappear.
But the Bund was making loud noises in New York. Why not German Americans or Italian Americans?
That's a very good question. I think, again, German Americans were better integrated, and they were, after all, Caucasians. They were white, like the rest of the majority. And as far as Italian Americans, there was actually an appeal made based on the fact that Joe DiMaggio's father was an Italian American. Therefore, how could we possibly throw the father of an American icon into an internment camp?
I guess Ichiro Suzuki was not yet playing for Seattle. So.
No, exactly not.
And you say there were no distinctions made about who was relocated, no difference between a six-month-old child and a 45-year-old man or woman or a 60-year-old citizen.
Absolutely. They were even interning, if that's the proper word, the one-quarter or one-half Japanese American children who were born to Aleutian Islanders in Alaska. They were sending ships up to the Aleutian Islands to bring them back to the mainland.
My guest is Robert Asahina. He's written a book called Just Americans, How Japanese Americans Won a War at Home and Abroad. It is published by Gotham Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment. Was this his idea?
I think he was under a great deal of pressure from lots of sources. But in the end, he was the man responsible. His advisors, in fact, presented him with a sort of laundry list of what could be done, ranging from what actually was done, that is the roundup of 110,000 Japanese Americans, to much lesser options like, in effect, cordoning off security zones and keeping people out of them. Roosevelt chose not to do that. He essentially gave the power over the military to do whatever they wanted to do.
And even as late as 1944, his advisors were suggesting that he stop the relocation as the elections were nearing, and he refused to stop them.
It's one of the great mysteries. Hawaii, which actually was in a war zone, had ceased to be declared a war zone in the spring of 1944. But as late as November 1944, Roosevelt was still insisting that California was a war zone. And I think the only way to understand that is to look at domestic politics and see that Roosevelt and the Democratic Party were very concerned about a nativist backlash if he opened up the camps.
So what was the public's reaction to these relocations? Were there any critical newspaper editorials? Were there any columnists who were
Oh, absolutely. And actually more important was that in many local communities, Japanese Americans who either coming back from the army or being released from camps faced very severe cases of discrimination, ranging from outright hostility involving gunshots to their houses and burning down of their farms.
So civil libertarians weren't screaming that this was an outrage, these people were American citizens?
Well, one of the sad parts of the story is that the ACLU, which you would expect to be on the side of Japanese Americans, was not. And it was only the local branch in San Francisco that protested, whereas the national branch really slapped down the California branches.
And no one saw any parallels with what the Germans were doing with the Jews, taking them and relocating them?
Not at the time.
You say that although everyone knows about the internment camps, few know about the soldiers who fought in World War II. So let's talk a bit about, the 100th Battalion.
Right. What I found was remarkable was that Japanese Americans served as citizens. The 100th Battalion was made up of Hawaiian Japanese Americans who were already in the Army at the time of Pearl Harbor. And the Army didn't know what to do with them. And
so, but they were all Japanese?
Well, they had been part of two units that were representing the Hawaiian territories at that time. And after Pearl Harbor, the men in both of those units were segregated and put into a new unit that was called the 100th Battalion.
But segregation was common in the military at that time. African Americans were also segregated into units separate from the rest of the Army.
Right, but those were the only two units that were segregated by race, that is Japanese Americans and African Americans.
And like the African Americans, were their commanders not Japanese?
Their commanders were Caucasians. Mm-hmm.
Was the patriotism of the Japanese volunteers ever questioned by their officers?
I don't think by their officers. In fact, the officers were given the opportunity not to serve with the 100th Battalion in 442. So the officers who wound up serving with them were ones who were upholding their right to bear arms.
Where were the Hawaiians stationed? In Hawaii?
The Hawaiians began in Hawaii, but then after the Army segregated them, they were shipped to, of all places, Camp McCoy in Wisconsin, which was a big culture shock for a lot of them because they had actually never seen snow and, you know, learned a lot about the mainland, which, in fact, almost none of them had ever been to.
How long until the Army finally decided to allow Japanese Americans from the internment camps to also fight in the war?
It was about a year and a month after Pearl Harbor, that is, at the beginning of 1943, that Roosevelt sort of reversed course and presented what he called the opportunity for Japanese Americans to serve their country.
Had the Hawaiians already been shipped to fight overseas?
Yeah, at that point, the Hawaiians in the 100th Battalion were on the mainland, but they hadn't yet gone into battle. They were still in training.
But they were the plan was to send them to Europe, not
yes.
to
mm-hmm.
the Pacific theater,
right.
because there was fear that they might not fight as hard against their own?
I think that was it, although, again, one of the great ironies of this whole story is that as early as the spring of 1942, when Japanese Americans were still being moved into the relocation camps, one branch of the Army, the Military Intelligence Service, started recruiting people out of the camps on the perfectly sensible notion that since the United States was at war with Japan, you might as well get people who spoke Japanese. And yet that whole recruitment effort, in effect, contradicted the movement of all the Japanese Americans into the camps.
So they were soliciting people, but selectively.
Very selectively, yeah.
How many wound up volunteering from the camps?
The initial volunteer was very small. It was about 1,200 men. Hawaii, by contrast, there were about 10,000 men who volunteered. And at the time, the Army and the government were disappointed that, as they put it, only 1,200 men volunteered. And yet I find it remarkable that 1,200 men volunteered at all from the camps.
Considering the way that they had been treated.
And considering that their families were still there. That is, they would be leaving, but their families would still remain in the camps.
Did any of these men ask to serve in the military, despite all of that?
Well, the 1,200 who volunteered in that initial round did.
Mm-hmm. And then later people were drafted.
Later they were drafted, but that, again, people need to keep this in context. Although we think of World War II as being the Great War and the greatest generation. In fact, 2/3 of the men who served in World War II overall were drafted, and only 1/3 volunteered.
My guest is Robert Asahina, who has been an editor at George Harper's, the New York Times Book Review, GEO, and the Public Interest, a film critic for The New Leader, and the American Spectator, and a theater critic for the Hudson Review. And he's also been editor-in-chief and deputy publisher of Broadway Books, president and publisher of the adult publishing group of Golden Books, and vice president and senior editor at Simon & Schuster. His book, Just Americans, How Japanese Americans Won a War at Home and Abroad, the story of the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II, is published by Gotham Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Robert Asahina, A-S-A-H-I-N-A, who's currently a visiting scholar at the Asian Pacific American Studies Program at NYU. He's written a book called Just Americans, How Japanese Americans Won a War at Home and Abroad. It's published by Gotham Books. Before we went into the break, I went through the impressive list of publishing jobs mm-hmm. that you've had over your career. Had you wanted to write this book during that time, or is this something that only was possible after you left that business?
I actually didn't know much about this story. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and was not really part of any Japanese-American community. So this story...
And your parents hadn't told you about the internment?
They were really not part of it. That is, neither one of my parents' families was interned. And my father briefly served with the 442, but was transferred out after a very short period. So it's not part of my family history. And I only actually thought about the idea when I read a newspaper story in the year 2000 when President Clinton awarded 20 upgraded Congressional Medals of Honor to Japanese-American soldiers who had not won them during World War II. Despite their valor. So their medals came about 60 years too late, but they were recognized.
Were they promised anything if they volunteered? Were they told that their families might be released?
No, they were given no assurances at all, except, as I said, that they were given the, quote, opportunity, unquote, to serve their country.
So let's talk about the reason that they were cited for valor. The fate of the 442nd is tied to the 36th Texas Division. How did that happen?
Well, there was a very dramatic series of battles in the Vosges Mountains in eastern France, which are a little like, I guess, like the Appalachians on the East Coast. They look like rolling hills from the distance, but they're actually quite dense and thick with underbrush. And in the fall of 1944, the 442nd found itself in the Vosges Mountains fighting along with the 36th Texas Division. And at the end of October, one battalion of the Texas Division found itself encircled and stranded on a mountaintop for 7 days. And the 442 was called in to rescue them.
They were called the Lost Battalion.
The Lost Battalion of the 36th Division. And for four very long days and nights, the 442 battled through the Vosges Mountains to free them.
Now, the 442 was also had been merged with the Hawaiians.
Right,
the 100th.
So the 100th and the 442 were one unit by that time.
So this was just an all Japanese American unit.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And everybody was an American citizen, or were there people who were promised citizenship as other immigrants were?
No, in this case, they were all American citizens.
Why were the 442nd sent out to rescue them?
Nobody really knows. I tried to find that one smoking gun document, which I couldn't find. There have been rumors over the years that they were being used as a kind of suicide squad, but I've never been able to confirm that. I think they just happened to be the closest troops and the freshest troops, so they were the logical choice.
But suicide squad, to some degree, describes the operation. They had a 4-day charge up booby-trap logging roads.
It was
at a very steep incline.
It was a nightmare. I climbed those hills myself when I was researching the book and was puffing and huffing by the time I got to the top of the hills. And I was not wearing a helmet. I was not carrying a rifle, wearing a knapsack. And, of course, there were no Germans shooting at me. And that fall, the weather was terrible. It rained almost every day. At the end of the period, it started snowing. And the 442 was in that area without winter gear. They were wearing the summer uniforms that they had in Italy.
What kinds of losses did they take?
At the end of the period, the unit as a whole, which has about 3,500 men, suffered close to 900 casualties. And by the time they left the Vosges Mountains a couple weeks later, they were down in strength to about 40% of what they had originally gone in with. So the casualties were horrific.
But they actually rescued the Lost Battalion?
They did, after 4 days. And one of the great ironies was that after they rescued them, the New York Times ran a wire story that said, "Doughboys rescue trapped unit." They did not refer to the 442. They did not mention Japanese Americans. And the photograph that the New York Times ran showed one of the members of the Lost Battalion shaking hands with a Caucasian officer. There were no Japanese Americans in the picture.
And do you think that was done on purpose? Or was it just people not being really sensitive to the situation?
They certainly weren't sensitive. These were official Army Signal Corps photos, so one has to assume some choices were made in how they were photographed.
Oh, but that might have been a decision of the military rather than of the New York Times. I'm not trying to defend the New York Times.
No, absolutely. I'm sure the Times ran what they got from the military.
That also suggests that the military was still uncomfortable about this battalion? Or didn't want it to get credit?
I think they were unsure what they wanted to do. In fact, there was some effort to publicize them because they wanted to, for propaganda purposes, show that they were loyal citizens and to show Japan, particularly, that we were not fighting a racist war, which was an allegation that the Japanese were making all the time.
But the decision wasn't made. On the other hand, because this was a turning point in winning the war in France, it also did affect policy toward the people in the internment camps.
Absolutely. I think there's a tendency now to look at what happened as a result of legal decisions, particularly Korematsu and Endo. But in my book, I make a very strong argument that it was really the performance of the soldiers that made a difference, because politically they could no longer charge that Japanese Americans were disloyal.
When was this? When did this take place?
This was the fall of 1944. About a week after the elections, there was a cabinet meeting at which Roosevelt met with his advisors. And coming out of that meeting, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, wrote a memo saying, "It's time to turn them loose," meaning Japanese Americans in the camps. And the reason he cited was the good record of Japanese Americans as soldiers.
So what did turning loose mean? When they returned home to to where they'd lived in California or Oregon or Washington or Arizona, were their homes still theirs?
In many cases, no. One of the great tragedies of the relocation was that Japanese Americans had so little time to make arrangements that they often had to just abandon their houses, their farms, their property, or they sold them at fire sale prices, or they left them in trust with people who, many of whom could not be trusted, and who wound up looting their assets.
And they had no legal recourse?
And they had no legal recourse.
Because of the circumstances of the internment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then what about when the soldiers returned? Were they treated like heroes?
Well, I have a very sad and poignant story of Daniel Inouye, who is now the senator from Hawaii, who had won a Distinguished Service Cross that was later, 60 years later, upgraded to a Congressional Medal of Honor. And he came back with a hook instead of an arm, which he had lost in Italy. He was wearing his medals on his chest. He was on his way across the mainland to go to a ship departing from Oakland to go back to Hawaii. He stopped for a haircut in San Francisco and was told by the barber, "You're a Jap, and we don't cut Jap hair." So that's the reception that a very decorated soldier got.
But as you mentioned, the Congressional Medals of Honor were awarded finally in 2000, although they did get other medals before. It still seems stunning to me that it took until 2000 for that to happen, considering the fact that their role in World War II has been recognized.
It had been, but I think it had been recognized at the level of the unit as a whole rather than in terms of individual heroism. And it was partly as a result of the reconsideration of Congressional Medals of Honor for African Americans that the movement to upgrade these medals for Japanese Americans happened.
But there was a movie based on this battalion, wasn't there? Gopher Broke?
Gopher Broke was made, amazingly enough, in 1951. So I think there was an awareness of the 442 and of Japanese Americans in the immediate post-war period that has sort of gone by the wayside for reasons I don't completely understand.
Were any of the Japanese Americans indicted or brought to trial for treason?
There were sort of two separate cases, groups of cases. One were people who were draft protesters, and three or four dozen of them actually served prison terms during the war. And the other case involved several thousand Japanese Americans who renounced their citizenship. But I think that was really mostly under pressure of the war, because almost all of them, after the war was over, renounced their renunciation and retained their American citizenship.
I had a guest here who had been in one of the internment camps, a woman who was young and was sent to Japan to relatives against her will.
Right. There was a lot of movement back and forth between, particularly between Hawaii and Japan, but also between the mainland and Japan. And this is one of the reasons that their loyalty was called into question, although I don't think it's really any different from the movement of most immigrant groups back and forth between the mainland and their homeland.
A listener writes, "It's my understanding that it was General John DeWitt, commander of the West Coast Military District, whose racism was a primary driver in the internment policy. It was his recommendation which prompted the policy by Roosevelt," which may or may not be true, but Roosevelt is this great president.
Exactly.
He's
Roosevelt,
still culpable, isn't he?
Roosevelt was the president, and his signature is on 9066. DeWitt was certainly in command of the troops on the West Coast, but he was not in a position to make government policy. He just had to implement it.
And how culpable do you hold FDR?
in the end, his signature is on 9066. And if you read the records as I have and spend as much time as I have in the National Archives, you'll see that Roosevelt was a very complex man and had lots of what we would now regard as prejudices. And I think he really wasn't in control of his own thoughts about Japanese Americans.
Well, he died after the internment camps were closed. So we don't know what Harry Truman would have done if it had been his decision.
Truman has said pretty forcefully at various times that he opposed it. He would not have implemented Roosevelt's policies. He thought it was a mistake. He, in fact, in his in the Plain Speaking, the autobiographical notes, said that it was one of the biggest mistakes the Army made, and he would have called them concentration camps because that's what they were.
Are you surprised that then this is being cited as a precedent today, considering the fact that most people consider this to be one of the more embarrassing moments in American history?
I'm astonished that Korematsu has never been overturned, that it's still on the books.
Well, has there been any reason to overturn it? We haven't had any situation until Guantanamo where we were interning people without charging them.
Well, one of the ironies I discovered is that it's actually liberals who have supported Korematsu for a sort of perverse reason, which is that Korematsu lays out the groundwork for what has become affirmative action, because in Korematsu it spells out the standards of strict scrutiny, which is one of the things that by now we have come to use to forbid racial classification. But that notion of strict scrutiny was advanced for the first time in Korematsu. So there's a kind of liberal reason not to overturn Korematsu because it might threaten the notion of strict scrutiny.
And then I mentioned earlier that there was a columnist, a conservative columnist, who saw all of this as a justification for racial profiling.
Again, I think this is a sort of a bizarre misunderstanding, because a profile should be something that helps us narrow the list of potential criminals or saboteurs or traitors. What happened after Pearl Harbor was the opposite of profile. That is, rounding up all 110,000 Japanese with no discrimination being made at all is completely the opposite of a profile.
Well, the listener points out that several thousand Italian Americans and German Americans were sent to the Dakotas, North and South Dakota, for several years during the war, and we don't hear much about that. But these were people who had actually shown that they were in opposition to the United States, that they might actually act as traitors.
There actually was a form of profiling that was going on to identify among the German-American community and the Italian-American community, and to a certain extent among the Japanese-American community, people who might be disloyal. But that's quite different from a mass roundup of 110,000 people.
And how many deportations were there? If people were not American citizens, were they? I know that there were Italian-Americans and German-Americans who were deported. What about Japanese-Americans?
There were certainly thousands of them. I don't have the exact figure. But many of them were not, most of them were not citizens. They were immigrants or residents of Japan who were living in the United States.
So now that you've started writing books, where do you go from here? You've been writing articles and reviews over the years, but
I'm now working, have been for the past couple of months, working at the New York Sun as a deputy managing editor. So I guess I'm...
So you're back to editing.
I'm sort of back to editing, but of course, once you've written one book, you know, you sort of feel as if you should be writing more. But it's an enormous investment of time and energy.
Well, in this case, you must, even though you say this was not part of your own past, you must have felt some kind of personal connection.
Well, it was amazing to me to be going to a place like Hawaii and sort of welcomed as a Japanese American, which growing up in Toledo, Ohio, is not an experience I ever had before.
What has happened in Hawaii? Hawaii never was disrupted in the way that the West Coast was.
No, and it had a very different experience after the war, which is that the veterans of the 100th and 442 came back determined to change their status. And 10 years later, there was what was known as the Quiet Revolution, when for the first time the Democratic Party took over control of the state legislature and the governorship. And almost all of those men who won those offices were veterans of the 442.
What's happened in the on the mainland? Have there been any attempts anywhere to redress grievances?
There was a small redress movement in the late 40s, which resulted in very, very tiny monetary payments to Japanese Americans. And then beginning in the 80s, there was a redress movement that resulted in about 1993, I think, of payments to Japanese Americans for what they suffered 60 years before.
Have there been any lawsuits? Have people sued the government for the internment, or does Korematsu eliminate the possibility?
Korematsu has pretty much eliminated that possibility. There were attempts to overturn the original convictions of people like Fred Korematsu, and they were, but nothing followed from the constitutional standpoint.
It's interesting that both this battalion and the segregated African-American battalion are among the most valorous in World War II. Do you think that they were motivated in ways that other soldiers might not have been?
I can't speak for African-Americans, but in my research among Japanese-Americans, they really felt they had something to prove, and that was a strong motive for the valor.
Robert Asahina's book, Just Americans, How Japanese Americans Won a War at Home and Abroad, the story of the 100th Battalion, 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II, is published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.